switched on. Good.
Right. Do we want down here then?
Well, I suppose the lifeboat could start with the lifeboat station. Is that?
Well, the original lifeboat station, of course, was at the middle of the promenade outside the Sefton Hotel.
Right.
On the other side of the road. And that later became a shelter. And then when they moved from there, they moved after, were able to move, as it were, when the swing bridge was built, because it meant that the men could get out quicker then, otherwise they were trying to run all the way around the harbour.
So when was the swing bridge?
Early 1890s. And then the first lifeboat station down here was on the other side of the road. It was in where the harbour board yard is. And there was just a slip on the seaward side, and they would bring the boat across the road and then down the slip. And then this one was built rather later. And the monument that's on it now, the plaque to Sir William Hillary, that originally had been on the wall below the Fort Anne. I say originally, that was where it was moved from to where it is now. Originally, that also had been over at the middle of Douglas Promenade. And when the shelter over there was demolished, it went into storage in the basement of the town hall and got lost. And it was Sammy Norris that rescued that, or made sure it was rescued, and it was then put up on the wall down there. Then, of course, later on, when the sea trade started to become containerised, one of the container firms was using down this end round by the breakwater, and the containers were always queued up right down the road, so you could walk down the road, and this poor plaque was then hidden behind the containers. So they then decided to move it onto the lifeboat house, where perhaps it should have been anyway, and where it couldn't actually get locked.
So the Fort Anne was in this bit in between?
The Fort Anne was further back.
Further down there.
The other side of Ravenscliff, between Ravenscliff and
Harold Towers?
The Towers, I think it is, isn't it? That one, and Harold Towers is the bigger one.
Right. Who's the architect for these?
Well, this one, Harold Towers, the big one, that was again John Welch, the same architect.
Right.
Yes, and more specifically for the Tower of Refuge.
Right.
And it was, I think, a James Newton, I think it was designed for, again, 1830s. But the sort of outworks of it, the walls and castellated frontage onto the bottom, that was part of the deal when land was transferred for the building of the approach road round here to the battery pier when that was being constructed. And the original battery pier was one of the Abernathy birdcage designs, which was a timber framing infilled with stone. But that got into trouble with the storms and had to be replaced. And here, it more or less had got swept away, or a good part of it had, whereas at Peel they caught it before too much damage was done. And at Peel, they really clad the Abernathy one, and just recently when they were digging trenches for services and things across it, they kept coming across the big timber beams, which were still there in place and still in quite good condition.
So the back pier,
the Victoria Pier is the outer one.
Right.
And that's been widened and extended since it was originally built. And in fact, at the end, you can also see where there have been some other alterations, where they've infilled some of the staircases down it to give longer berthing areas.
The red pier
was what is now the Edward Pier, the inner one, and that was extended. the end of it originally was more or less opposite to the end of the Fort Anne jetty, which really acted as a breakwater, because that was all you had, was that inner portion. The end of the Red Pier had that rather sort of bulbous nose with the fancy lighthouse on it, which had been designed by George Stewart, and the courthouse and other buildings just at the base of the pier were all part and parcel of a sort of unified design. Now there's only the one little piece of that building surviving.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about
this. Yes, the little fancy bit at the end. That's the last bit out of that little group of buildings, which included the courthouse.
So they're 18th century as well, aren't they?
Yeah, 1790s they are. And at the back of those, you've got more or less the one surviving bit of the red stone of the Red Pier. And you can just see one sort of wall of it just behind there, facing onto the inner, the Circus Beach parking area.
So the Fort Anne, what date was that built?
Well, that again is about the same, about 1790. Whether George Stewart had a hand in that or not is a bit of an open question, but certainly the appearance of it was such to suggest that he had. But we just don't know.
Why was it demolished? I mean, was it in really bad state of repair? Or, I mean, just the usual...
Are you tempting me?
Go on. Is it just the usual?
Not entirely. There are several stories. I mean, it might almost be actionable part of it. But it had gone into the hands of Head and Hotels, and at that time I was looking after certain bits of work on it and so on for them. The building wasn't in too good a condition, by and large. But they decided that they were going to do quite a bit of work to it. In the centre block, which was the old piece, to open up a rather rough, tatty basement area they had and put a basement bar in. And they were also going to put bathrooms in bedrooms. There's a number had already had some in, but they were put more in. But unfortunately, the people that they chose to do the work were from Dublin, who actually did film studio work over there and who were used to doing things so that they actually sort of, as it were, looked good, but the construction was somewhat dubious. And they had to dig out to create this basement bar under the centre block, which they put in, and which yes, all sorts of things, yes. And then the next slope that everybody knew was that, first of all, they were finding water trickling around where there shouldn't have been water, and then the whole of the building above started to crack.
Oh.
And they sort of realised they'd dug into the ground and removed the foundations from under the walls, so the whole thing really got into a rather nasty state. And at more or less the same time, a piece of the front wall of the parking area, the terracing in front of the building, blew out one day, suddenly cascaded down the hillside. And when we went to look, we realised that there had been water backing up behind it. And at the same time, or roughly the same time, one of the drains from one of these ensuite bathrooms started to flush the gully outside. So we had to investigate and find out where these sewers were going. We knew there was a sewer going around the end of the building and across the front, and we knew there was one setting off from this gully going out to meet it. And when we sort of traced the two at the same place, we found that they didn't meet. They'd just assumed that they had, and they'd connected the toilet into this gully drain, and the gully drain just ended behind the wall.
Didn't
go to the main sewer. Uh-huh. So of course that wasn't blown the wall out. It was just acting like a sort of soak away cum septic tank in a length of pipe. It was a right mess.
Oh,
but I mean, that was really the final straw.
The Douglas Head Hotel. Who was?
Don't know who actually designed that. The one piece of it that we perhaps do know is the tower, because that was one of two landmark towers which were designed by Thomas Brine. He was the clerk of works to the barracks office. That's how he came to the island. And he was responsible for the main part of the work in converting Castle Rushen into the prison in 1816. He did a lot of other work as well. He, in fact, in a sense, took over the mantle of George Stewart after Stewart died, and took over a lot of the works for the Duke of Atholl. In fact, the barracks office had been going to move Brine from the island to somewhere else. He'd had his posting orders, decided that he didn't want to stay, that he had quite a lucrative little sideline private set up here, particularly doing work for the Duke of Atholl. And the Duke of Atholl persuaded him to pack up the barracks office and stay. And he did quite a lot of work. But working for the barracks office, he had designed these two landmark towers, one on Langness, now always known as the Herring Tower, but in fact it was purely a landmark tower. And that was so that you could see this low-lying piece of land, which you otherwise might not see from the deck of the ship. It actually gave a marker before the lighthouse, long before the lighthouse was built. And the other one up here, because from the sea you've got three headlands in a row hiding, which is actually Douglas Harbour, which is where you're running to in the storm. So the tower was put to mark the one which you wanted, and that's the start of it. But Brine appears to have had somewhat sort of antiquarian interests, and he very faithfully copies the design of the Irish Round Tower at Peel. So if you look at either of those two towers, they're very close to Peel. And then later, when he did the work in the castle, he incorporated into it very fine Carnarvon arches, shouldered arches, into the work in the prison works. So to some extent, he confuses the issue. To sometimes look a bit carefully to see what's going on, and most people just don't, and just think that bits are all, because they've got those arches, they're all the same edge. But he added a few in the areas where he put new walls and new doors in, which is not a thing that you would have expected to be done at that particular period. You'd have expected that if he'd been putting prison doors in a new wall, even if it was in an old building, that he'd have just put a straightforward square-headed door.
Fancy, no.
But that wasn't his style.
Like to get satisfaction.
Yes, and again, when he did buildings like the House of Keys building in Castletown, he followed designs which had originated with George Stewart, sort of 20 or 30 years before, and he just modified those rather than doing totally new designs. So, you know, he's a very strange character and very complex, really, in what he got up to.
Shall we wander around towards the lighthouse?
Yes, well, lots of things. I mean, more or less where we were standing, just sort of at the base of the breakwater. So that's where the little kiosk was, where the ferries came across to. They came across from where the outer link span is, and just ferried people backwards and forwards across the harbour. Next to that, more or less where the oil berth is now, and rather bigger than it, was the cattle berth, which had timber stagings, so you could get cattle, live cattle, on and off the boats. And here, when we're walking across, you've got the broad gauge rails of the big steam crane. Now, the big steam crane was there for a long time afterwards, in on the bottom end of what is Manx Petroleum's storage area. But that does show again on quite a number of the photographs and things. And then one of the transport photographs is quite close to the base of the battery pier, just roughly where the toilets are, which is of one of the steam engines arriving on the island for the Inverbeck Railway. And it's on its low loader there, waiting to be hauled away. And now walking up the road from Manx Petroleum's towards the Coast Guard rescue station, all the little bits along the side of us, little sort of terraced areas, those were all fairground kiosks. And you had all the stalls and everything else along there. And they were there, again, right through, certainly into the 60s. Some of them survived quite long. And the Coast Guard building, that was a cafe restaurant building. One of the little buildings had one of these fancy brass scales, you know, that you sit on one end of. Well, not weigh yourself, but it had a little seat, you know, and they piled the weights on the other end. And then the top platform, where people use as a viewing platform, that also had kiosks on it. And of course, this is the area which gives its name to the pier and everything anyway, because this was the site of the Douglas Gun Battery. That's where the name comes from. It's the battery pier, and the battery was on this platform. And there are the remains of a couple of bits of the buildings just beyond the little quarry area. You can see one of the buildings dug into the hillside. Now, this was something that we found quite a bit on when we were researching Castle Rushen, because we got Harry Gordon Slade to look in the Public Record Office in London for some of the plans that we knew ought to exist of Thomas Brines and other associated people, Captain Holloway and others working with him, that we didn't have copies of on this side. And Harry picked up some of those, quite a few of those, but he also picked up the drawings for the three major gun batteries that were done in 1816. Right. That was the Douglas one at Ramsey, at sort of Portavullen area. And where was the other one? Can't think now. There were three anyway. Oh, the Peel one.
Yeah.
The one in the castle. So you've got the sort of section drawing of that, and those are now, there are copies of those now in the museum files. But as I say, that came out of looking for stuff for Castle Rushen, and knowing from the documents that we had that Brine had involvements in some of these things, and that there ought to be stuff surviving. And ultimately it was enough to persuade Harry to go and look. Now, also in this area, on the other side, you're round to the lighthouse. The lighthouse, of course, had been reconstructed once. The old one was...
Lady Bird.
lady of man coming in. The older lighthouse was squatter and wider and had a sort of solid platform and stepped in. And then the area between us and the lighthouse was the Portskillian swimming baths. And there were buildings right along the little spur headland between us and the lighthouse. That little, as it were, spur of rocks that stick out. All the buildings were along that as the original lighthouse. You see how different it is in style, but that exists. There are a number of photographs, not many postcards, because of course it had gone just at the time when postcards started. I can't remember now what date Douglas was. It was one of the earlier ones of the Manx lighthouses, not right at the beginning. The early ones are about 1819, aren't they? The Calf lights and the Point of Ayre. I have a feeling Douglas is about 1830 something. I'm not sure, but I mean, all those documents are there.
Yeah.
As I say, there are a number of photographs of the original building, but not too many. So it's nice to get it on the postcard.
So why did they rebuild?
I don't know whether the old light was getting in trouble or whether it was a question that they needed. It's a very different lantern that's on it. It may have been to do with that, but certainly it was considerably altered at that stage. And the other card, which is an early one again, also shows the ferries on the outer harbour and again the paddle boats. What's interesting about the ferries on this one is that there are two very distinctly different ferries, one much smaller than the other. And again, we've not been able to quite work out what's happening with those. The cards themselves, those two cards are interesting. I mean, obviously that one, which is dated as 1904, and the other one, they are a matching set, as it were. So that must have really been something that was being issued quite late. But they're both by the British and Colonial Auto Trading Company Limited. Now, yeah, like pulling faces. But the interesting thing is that on the one of the outer part of the harbour, the person sending it has absolutely plastered it in some tiny little script. But in the middle of it, it says, "This card is one I got out of an automatic machine at Castletown Station. Put a penny in the slot and you get two cards." So that was rather a nice little piece of information, because I hadn't thought of them having postcards being dispensed by machine. And they're both by this one firm whose name is on them. So that was a little bonus with that one. But of course there are a lot of pictures which exist of the harbour area, and many of them of course showing the red pier with its fancy bits and the Imperial buildings, which had been the Imperial Hotel. And of course replaced by the present Imperial buildings, although on a different site, because the Imperial Hotel had been turned into the Imperial buildings when it became the offices for the Steam Packet Company, and it was their offices for some time. Again, other pictures post-war showing harbourside cranes and things from the days when all the cars had to be craned on and off the boats.
Yeah.
You know, that was very jolly. And then cards from some of the photographers' kiosks, which have got painted backgrounds of Douglas Head, some of them including the Warwick Tower up on the top. the big tower, which had this circular platform which raised and lowered and which turned. It was an American patent. The engineer's name was Warwick, and there were a number of them in various, mainly seaside places in the British Isles, but also in the States. The one here only lasted in its full working condition for about 12 months, and then there was a fire which damaged it and burned out the engine house. But they then set it, and they used the area under it for swings and things for a while. And it stayed, I think, perhaps another 5 years or something before it was demolished. But why they should ever want one on Douglas Head, I really don't know. You know, I can understand them having one at the end of the promenade at Great Yarmouth. Nice flat area, no hills. So if you want a distant view, you have your ride up the tower. But on the top of Douglas Head, what you're getting from going up the tower really is only fractionally different to what you get
what
just
you
by standing
anyway, yeah.
on the ground. It doesn't make sense.
Well,
that's probably it. And they were a sort of novelty. And many of those things like that, and even things like the Blackpool Tower Company, had connections in the Isle of Man with companies here. So you were getting Manx-registered companies developing all sorts of funny things in seaside resorts. So,
like the proposals for the tower here.
Yes, yeah, yes. But many those sort of things were being done in other places,
yeah.
but from Manx-based companies. So that in itself was quite interesting. And then what must be a mid-1930s view across the harbour, although more specifically of a car of the period and a rather dapper driver, mm-hmm. but the background with the big crane that was obviously being used to construct the Edward Pier, and then a landau up on the top with the poles of the railway system running out along the Marine Drive, which of course this year is celebrating the railway part, not the drive itself, celebrating its centenary.
Yeah.
So
when were the baths going full swing? Was that
at the turn of the century? Uh-huh. I mean, there you've got a picture, you can see something of
were they mixed?
How
baths?
No, not originally. Oh no 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 no. It was men only.
Oh. Good.
Which is why the ladies all decorated these paths and things where we are, watching the gentlemen at play. It was the opposite way round.
Yeah, spying.
Well, spying? Not really, not really. I mean, they were doing it quite openly, and spying if you'd been hiding, but... there are quite a lot, again, of stories of them, the ladies... being up on the slopes here, watching them at play in the baths. But, you know, quite complex arrangement and quite a heavy wall across. The remains of the wall can be seen at low tide. It's now sort of level with the shingle, which is right through the area. And, of course, up on the top... around the hotel, yes,
yeah.
You've got the central tower, which is still there, still very obvious. But you had a whole grouping of buildings around that with rifle ranges and all sorts. And an open-air theatre, and of course that was reconstructed, and parts of that still exist.
Yeah.
And both in the interwar period and again after the war, there were open-air church services held up there on a Sunday afternoon. You had the big open-air service at Braddon,
yeah.
of course, in the morning. But in the afternoon, there was one there. One stage, it had been the bishop had often done it. And then in the later period, after the war, it was largely a Methodist-run organisation, with, of course, the Church of England one being the Braddon one in the morning. But it was a very informal thing, and people, some would sit in the seats... Yeah. of the amphitheatre, and others would just be sprawled around on the hillside, but they'd have hymn sheets dished out to them, and they'd have a sing-song and all the rest of it. It was quite, you know...
Is there one over that side, a Catholic one?
Well, you've over on the other side of the bay, yes, you've got the Catholic open area, with the Lourdes Grotto, yeah. And they had a service, an open-air service, in the area in front of the grotto. And then, of course, you've got the Calvary Glen with the Stations of the Cross, which yeah. came, as it were, tumbling down the hillside, down to the back of the tramway offices. And then the church building itself, and of course the church was rebuilt with the present one that you've got there.
Right. Okay.
Now, from where we are here, you then had the incline railway, which took you up to the top, to the area just below the hotel, and of course the point at which that Marine Drive railway started. And you can see that here with the bed of the railway running up, with the steps running up the right-hand side of it. And this was just two tracks, you know, with trucks on, as it were, on opposite ends of a piece of string, right. And an engine system and a braking system at the top. And some of the details exist of the way that the thing was coupled up and operated. Mm-hmm. What the relationship was, I'm not quite sure, but there was obviously a relationship with Clucas's Laundry in the later years, in the sort of post-war, post-45 period, because the engineer from the laundry looked after this. So just what the actual connection was, I'm not sure. And then part way up above the steps, you've got an earth bank, which you can see reasonably distinctly, just above the steps, the right of them, which was another gun battery. That was the Naval Volunteer Reserve battery. And that was there from quite early on. And then, of course, as we're looking from here across, you've got the camera obscura, you've got Coast Guard Hut and so on behind it. Those are all relatively well documented. One of the things which I remember from the war years, the end of the war years, was a plane crash up here where a plane which was stunting for the Naval Radio and Radar Training School, which of course their classroom block was what is now Max Radio. That was built specially, and they had all the hotel area and everything else. And of course their living quarters was HMS Valkyrie, which were the two blocks either side of the Promenade Methodist Church, the block that the church is at the end of, and the one, the harbour side of it, those two blocks. They were wired off, and that was HMS Valkyrie. And they marched up here to the to their training school. But this plane used to, and where the mast is for the Douglas television booster up on the top, there were a couple or more of wooden masts up there, which were early radar masts and so on, and they were all part of this training establishment. And this plane used to come round and fly around mornings and other odd times, and one day it tried stunting, as it were, flying between the lighthouse and the rocks, and caught the rocks, ripped one of its flaps off, went into a vertical climb, and stalled and spun out and dropped. And the pilot managed to get out, but unfortunately hit below here, where, more or less where the baths were, before his parachute opened, so he was killed. And the plane crashed into the end of the old gun battery, the reserve gun battery, just nosedived straight in. I was, I can't remember whether I was going to school or coming home from school, I can't for the life of me remember, but no doubt the records of the crash would show what time. But I was outside the newsagent's shop which used to be at the bottom of Broadway. Because that area there, the end of Clarence Terrace, there were a group of shops ran through from the end of the terrace right through to level with the end of the Central Hotel. And one of those was the newsagent, which was Plants, and I was outside that when watching this plane when it actually happened.
You can see the court building.
Yes, you can see the little bit of it, the octagonal building. And then, of course, as we're walking down, you've got the whole later stuff with the Stabbits and everything. And, of course, now, when you go out to Port Sodrick, it's interesting looking at the field where they constructed those, that there's really no sign at all in the field that it had been used for making them. They did a good job of tidying that up. And that's one of the fields just alongside the road into Kerrystal from the bottom of Oak Hill, just past the corrugated iron building, which was the toll house for the Marine Drive at that end. This end, there was a toll house attached to the stone arch across the road. The toll house was sat right out on the, built projecting up from the cliff. Must have been quite a spectacular place to live, especially in bad weather in the winter. And you were right out on the edge, and the wind howling past there. It must have been quite something. Yes.
Press